Welcome to Leonard Legal Buzz from the law firm of Leonard Street & Dinard. Today's unions are fighting to survive. In order to stay alive, they must increase their organizing efforts. The Employee Free Choice Act has the potential to radically change labor relations as we know it. Employers will need to be proactive if they want to remain union-free. Here to discuss the ramifications of this pending legislation is Dominic Ciceri, chair of Leonard Street & Dinard's Labor and Employment Law Department, and Tim Ewald, another shareholder at Leonard Street & Dinard specializing in labor relations. Dominic and Tim have been representing non-union and union employers for over 15 years. Dominic, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Dom, let me start with you. What is the Employee Free Choice Act?
The Employee Free Choice Act is essentially an effort to breathe new life into organized labor. You know, union membership has been on the decline for the last several years. In their heyday, unions represented nearly 40% of the employees in this country. Now they represent less than 8% of the employees working in the private sector. They frankly need to organize in order to survive. And despite repeated stated commitments to organizing and a lot of money, unions have not had much success. They need to do something drastic, and that drastic action is the Employee Free Choice Act. It's a bill currently being considered by Congress that would amend the National Labor Relations Act and radically change the way unions organize employees. It would require government involvement in the negotiation process at the very early stages of bargaining. It would also require binding arbitration if a company and a union are unable to reach a negotiated agreement after just 4 months. And finally, and most significantly, it would eliminate secret ballot elections.
And how do union organizing campaigns work now?
Well, the official beginning of the organizing process is the filing of a petition with the National Labor Relations Board. Now, that petition must be supported by authorization cards signed by at least 30% of the proposed bargaining unit. Now, the bargaining unit is nothing more than the group of employees that the union is attempting to organize. Once that petition is filed, a secret ballot election is scheduled by the National Labor Relations Board. That election generally takes place within about 40 days of the filing of the petition, and the election generally takes place at the employer's place of business, and it's supervised by an agent of the National Labor Relations Board. Once the polls close, the agent counts the ballots. If a majority of the ballots cast are cast in favor of the union wins, and then the parties begin the process of bargaining and continue until they reach agreement. Now, while the petition is the official beginning of the process, in reality, there are weeks, months, even years of quiet, covert, behind-the-scenes activity prior to the time that petition is filed. And it's during that period of time that professional union organizers will make home visits to employees, will meet with them one-on-one, all in an effort to convince employees to sign authorization cards. As you can imagine, during these one-on-one conversations, employees only hear one side of the story about what it means to be represented by a union. Now, after the petition is filed, but before the election, there's a period of time that's referred to in the National Labor Relations Act as the laboratory period. And it's during that period of time that employers launch an information campaign, essentially an effort to educate their employees about what it really means to be represented by a union. And so for the period of time between the filing of the petition and the election, generally 4 to 6 weeks, employers will hold employee meetings, they'll send letters to employees' homes, and they'll put postings in the workplace, all in an effort to ensure that employees make informed decisions when they cast their secret ballots at the election. This laboratory period is critically important to ensuring employees hear both sides of the story before they vote. If the union wins an election, the law requires that the union and the company sit down and bargain in good faith in order to reach a first contract. Before that bargaining begins, however, employers spend a significant amount of time developing a comprehensive bargaining strategy. Now, while the law requires good faith bargaining, it does not require that the parties reach agreement within any specific time frame. First contracts are very important, and it is not at all unusual for it to take 8, 10, 12 months, sometimes longer, to reach agreement on a first contract. At the end of the day, everything in the contract has been agreed to by both the union and the company.
Tim, how would the Free Choice Act change the way unions organize and collectively bargain?
Well, the Free Choice Act would change labor law in three major ways, as Dom has briefly touched upon. First of all, the secret private ballot process that's currently in effect for choosing or rejecting union representation would be replaced by a more public card check process. Secondly, the federal government would intervene into employer union contract negotiations fairly early in the process and would even be able to force the parties to submit any unresolved issues to binding arbitration. And then finally, the penalties against employers for unfair labor practices or violations of the law during the laboratory period that Dom talked about would be dramatically increased and really would become rather punitive in nature.
You mentioned the shift from a secret ballot to a card check. Walk us through what that means exactly.
Sure. Well, currently, as Dom mentioned, employees are able to select or reject union representation by casting this secret confidential ballot in a government-supervised election. And under that current system, no one would ever know how an individual employee voted during the election. Under the Free Choice Act's card check process, however, a union would become the certified bargaining representative if it's able to get a majority of the workforce to sign those authorization cards. Now, that process effectively replaces privately cast ballots with publicly signed cards. And that process is really troubling in a number of ways. First, the elimination of the secret ballot process makes it less likely that an employee is really going to express his or her true opinion on unionization. Currently, an employee can privately cast that ballot, vote his or her conscience inside the voting booth without any real pressure and without any real fear that someone's going to find out how they voted. That safeguard disappears when a union is allowed to organize by getting an employee to publicly sign a card. Professional union organizers are going to be able to go to an employee's house, give an employee a sales pitch, and tell him or her to sign a card. And it can be really difficult for an employee to resist that kind of pressure. And unions have been known to mislead or even intimidate employees in the past during campaigns.
There are countless stories of employees who have told us of the pressure and intimidation when it comes to the signing of an authorization card. We've had employees that have told us after the fact that they didn't even know what it was that they were signing. Employees have told us that professional union organizers have visited their homes night after night after night until finally, just to stop the home visits, they've signed the cards. We've also heard stories of union organizers suggesting to foreign-born employees that the cards they were signing were not union authorization cards at all, but rather work authorization cards that needed to be signed in order for the employees to continue to work in this country. We've even heard from employees who have understood that the authorization cards were actually raffle tickets. While there are plenty of union organizers that wouldn't think of using these sorts of tactics to get cards signed, unfortunately, stories of pressure and intimidation and misinformation are not at all uncommon in a union organizing drive.
The bottom line is that forcing an employee to express his or her view on unionization in public, surrounded by union organizers, perhaps surrounded by vocal co-workers, makes it less likely that that employee is going to reveal his or her true feelings on the matter. And there's a reason that we're all allowed to cast a secret ballot during a political election. And those same notions of fairness should continue to apply to unions in their organizing efforts, but they simply wouldn't under the Free Choice Act. Another troubling aspect of the card check process is that the employer's ability to tell its side of the story is eliminated, as Dom previously mentioned, and employees instead would only hear the union's high-pressure sales pitch. The way it works now, as has been mentioned, is that the union files this organizational petition, the election is set by the government 30 or 40 days later, and then each side can use that period of time to campaign and express its own opinion on unionization. In a card check setting, the way that it would work is that union organizers would approach employees, they'd make sales pitches, and then they would pressure them to sign cards. Those employees may never hear the employer's position on unionization, and as a result, the employees could end up signing the card after only hearing one side of the story. And hearing only one side of the story just makes it much less likely that the employees will make informed decisions on unionization.
Could you also elaborate on how the mandatory government intervention and binding arbitration would work under this act?
Sure. The way that collective bargaining works now, as Dom has mentioned, is that after a union is certified following the election, the employer and the union sit down at a table, they negotiate in good faith to see if they can reach agreement on a labor contract. Since contracts can contain dozens of complicated provisions, they can be many pages long, it's not uncommon for the union and the employer to negotiate for many months. They can even negotiate for a year or more, particularly when you're dealing with a first contract. If the union and the employer cannot reach agreement, either party can then apply economic pressure, unions through strikes, companies through lockouts, but the parties are generally in control of the bargaining process throughout. The way bargaining would work under the Free Choice Act would be very different. The act would require the employer to sit down with the union and begin bargaining only 10 days after the union is certified. Now, that's a really short time for an employer that has no union experience, perhaps didn't even know that a union organization effort was underway, to have to sit down at a table with professional union negotiators and begin to hammer out a first-ever contract. The act then requires that if the parties do not reach agreement on a contract after 90 days of bargaining, a mediator will be sent in from the government to try to help the parties reach agreement. Finally, the act provides that if the parties still do not reach agreement within 30 days after that federal mediator is sent in, the parties must submit all remaining disputes to an unaccountable, potentially government-appointed arbitrator who then will issue a binding decision. Now, this arbitrator likely will have no history whatsoever with the parties, may have no history whatsoever with the employer's industry, and yet he or she will be able to establish any working conditions such as wages, benefits, hours of production, etc., that remain unresolved at the table. So the reality of bargaining under the Free Choice Act is that the parties lose control of the process and eventually have to turn it over to an arbitrator who, unlike the employer and the employees, doesn't even have to live with his or her own decision. This would really radically change collective bargaining as we know it.
You also mentioned increased penalties for employers. What specifically would change with respect to those penalties under this new law?
Well, the way it currently works is that if an employer or a union violates the law or commits an unfair labor practice during the laboratory period, appropriate penalties like back pay or reinstatement would be assessed. Under the Free Choice Act, the penalties for employers, but not unions, would be greatly increased. For example, employers found to have violated the law could be responsible for up to triple back pay and civil penalties of up to $20,000. That's really punitive in nature. And it bears repeating that the act only increases penalties against employers, but does not increase penalties against unions. And it is not uncommon for unions to have charges of unfair labor practices leveled against them during campaigns. This is really further evidence that the act tilts the scales in favor of unionization.
Now, we are recording this podcast prior to the November 4th election, so we can't know exactly what will happen. But in general, do you think the Free Choice Act will pass?
Well, certainly much is going to depend on the upcoming November elections, but it seems likely that some version of the Free Choice Act will become law in the future. Unions spent over $100 million in 2006 to help Democrats gain control of Congress, and they've currently spent over $50 million backing candidates who support the Free Choice Act. So the passage of the act is a real priority for organized labor. Now, the legislative history of the act is that the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed it in March of 2007, and then the bill was introduced into the Senate. And interestingly, Barack Obama and Joe Biden were actually co-sponsors of the bill in the Senate, which gives you an idea of their feelings on the legislation. Ultimately, the bill was hung up in the Senate in 2007, and basically now everyone is simply waiting to see what will happen with the Senate elections, to see if the balance of power will shift and lead to a vote on the act. With 35 Senate seats up for grabs, the balance of power in the Senate certainly could change. Bottom line is, we simply can't know for sure what will happen, but we do expect some version of the act to pass in the coming future.
And finally, what can businesses do to get ready to meet the challenges of the Free Choice Act?
Well, you know, employers really do need to be proactive now rather than reactive later when their employees may have already looked to an outsider for help. That may be a time when it would be too late to make a difference. And this proactive approach really needs to focus on positive employee relations, not union bashing. The best way to prevent a union organizing drive is to do what you can to ensure that your employees believe, truly believe, that there is nothing that a union can do for them that they cannot do better for themselves. And the best way to achieve that result is to focus on three things: effective communication, company-wide employee participation, and genuine recognition. You know, several years ago, I wrote an article entitled CPR Can Keep Your Business Union Free. It's a corny title, but it's an easy way to remember the essential components of a union-free workplace. Communication, participation, recognition. It really is that simple. CPR is truly the best way to ensure ongoing positive employee relations and keep your business union-free. If employees believe they are not informed or not involved and or not appreciated, they may well turn to a union for help, and unions will jump at the chance. Employers need to know if there are unresolved issues or unanswered questions that may be causing some of their employees some level of frustration or even anger. They need to know if their managers and supervisors are connecting with their direct reports, whether they truly know their people, and whether they truly have their fingers on the pulse of employee relations. Employers need to know whether their managers and supervisors are informed about what it truly means to be represented by a union. They also need to know whether the managers and supervisors are comfortable knowing what they can and cannot say about unions and union organizing drives. And finally, employers need to know whether they have the systems in place to ensure positive employee relations and effectively combat a union organizing drive. Now, that's a lot to know. And one of the ways to gain this essential knowledge is to conduct a union vulnerability or positive employee relations audit. Such an audit would give employers a chance to learn the issues that may be bubbling just below the surface and to address those issues before the first rumors of a union organizing effort. If employers wait until rumors of an organizing effort to address these issues, it will either be too late to legally do anything about it, or frankly, it will allow the union to take credit for any positive changes that take place. An audit allows employers to gain an understanding of their supervisors' and managers' relationships with their people. It's those relationships which form the foundation of positive employee relations. And finally, an audit provides an opportunity to educate managers and supervisors about unions and the union organizing process. The process as it exists now, and what that process may look like if the Employee Free Choice Act is eventually signed into law. The bottom line is, regardless of who wins on November 4th, regardless of whether the Employee Free Choice Act passes in its current form or some modified version, change is on the horizon when it comes to union organizing efforts. Unions need to organize in order to survive, and unions are big businesses, and they have every intention of surviving.
Well, Dominic and Tim, you've certainly given our listeners a lot to consider. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. If you'd like to learn more about the Employee Free Choice Act, we invite you to contact us at 612-335-1500 or visit us online at www.leonard.com. Leonard Street & Dinard is among Minnesota's largest law firms, with offices in Minneapolis, St. Cloud, and Mankato, Minnesota, and in Washington, D.C. From its regional base, Leonard Street & Dinard serves clients throughout the United States and internationally. The firm employs nearly 200 attorneys in more than 40 practice areas, and since its founding in 1922, has helped generations of clients achieve their business objectives through astute legal advice complemented by good common sense. To learn more, visit Leonard Street & Dinard's website at www.leonard.com. This podcast is provided by the law firm of Leonard Street & Dinard as a service to clients and the general public. The information contained in this recording is neither designed nor intended to be relied upon as specific legal advice to any individual or organization. Listeners should always consult with their attorney about specific legal matters.